Asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Ollie Barrett. 25 people have been killed in an eruption of the Fuego volcano in Guatemala. Hundreds more are injured in the strongest eruption the country's seen in decades. 3 days of national mourning have been declared by President Jimmy Morales. The volcano, 25 miles southwest of the capital Guatemala City, has been sending ash, smoke and rocks into the sky and a flow of lava towards nearby villages. It's less than 2 weeks now before the world's biggest football championship begins in Russia. Last-minute World Cup preparations are underway at the 12 venues spread across 11 cities. The hosts play the opening match against Saudi Arabia in Moscow's Luzhniki Stadium on June the 14th, as Jessica King reports from Moscow.
The atmosphere is building as Russia prepares to welcome over 1 million international visitors and fans. Airports and transport hubs are gearing up to deal with the crowds. From Monday, anyone with a match ticket and their fan ID can enter Russia visa-free. The FIFA World Cup trophy has been unveiled in Moscow's Red Square after travelling to more than 50 countries during its 9-month global tour. It'll be awarded to the winners in Moscow on July 15th.
A fire safety expert's report to the Grenfell Tower inquiry says advice for residents to stay put failed within around half an hour of the blaze starting in London last year. The public inquiry's moved into its second phase, looking at the cause and spread of the inferno on the 14th of June, which killed 72 people. Paul Barber reports from London.
Dr. Barbara Lane's report is one of five published as part of the fact-finding stage of the Grenfell Tower inquiry. In it, the expert says there was an early need for a total evacuation of the building after the fire rapidly spread from its source in a flat on the fourth floor. The fire service's advice had been for residents to stay put, and that didn't change until nearly 2 hours after the first emergency call. Dr. Lane's report also states that tests had shown cladding used on the tower's exterior did not comply with recommended fire performance set out in guidance for such buildings. 72 people died as a result of the disaster.
The deaths of 48 migrants off the Tunisian coast over the weekend are raising fresh concerns about the crisis in the Mediterranean Sea. In Slovenia, elections have resulted in another European Union country voting an anti-immigration party into power. Jack Parrott reports.
The 48 migrants who died near the Tunisian coastline added to 9 people, including 6 children who lost their lives after a speedboat sank off the coast of Turkey. 67 migrants were saved from the boat near Tunisia. Already this year, around 700 people have died trying to cross the Mediterranean, according to the International Organization for Migration. And that number is only expected to rise as the weather becomes warmer. The weekend also saw a rise in the number of EU countries being led by anti-immigration parties after an election in Slovenia. It adds to the newly formed Italian coalition government, which promises to deport 500,000 migrants, Italy now the main entry point for migrants into Europe.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Ollie Barrett. Listening to the Grenfell news today, I can't get my head around this, and I know nothing about fighting fires, it must be said. Very important to put that caveat on it, but I can't get my head around fire experts and fire departments telling people to stay where they are when there's a clear path to the front door through emergency exits. I just can't get my head around that. Not making any insinuations, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Welcome to Monday's programme. I hope you've had a really good weekend. Another beautiful day here in the great city of Manchester. It's June 4th, 2018. Thanks for joining me. Let's do it then. Got a really, I think a really exciting show lined up for you this Monday to kick off the week. Let's do it. Let's do it now.
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, I was very eager there. I must have hit about 5 buttons at the same time, simultaneously. Monday. I'm looking forward to catching up with Professor Steve Keen. He was on this program last year. It's about a year since he was on. He heads up the School of Economics, History and Politics at Kingston University in London. He's an author as well. First came across him back in 2008. We're going to talk about developments in Italy, developments here in the UK, what it means for the future of the European Union, and more besides Steve Keane. And in the second hour, we're off to Acapulco to Jeff Berwick, the dollar vigilante himself. We'll talk trade wars, Donald Trump and the European Union, and more besides. Jeff's the top man. It's been a while since he was on the programme. So pretty packed show. Two very interesting guests, as usual. If you'd like to participate, join in with a comment or two, tweet them to me. It's at Richie Allen Show. Couldn't be easier. At Richie Allen Show. And you can join in with others whom are very loquacious on Twitter, very verbose. Lots to say, our listeners. You can join in with them, argue with them, agree with them, or whatever on Twitter. Monday's programme then live on Fab Radio 2 here, richieallen.co.uk. Trigger warning, Cogent Radio, and Tune In Radio as well. Plenty of places to hear this programme. Rightio! Right, so let's jump straight into the news roundup then, straight in there without any further ado. Now, the EU withdrawal bill will return to the House of Commons for a series of votes on June 12th. It was announced late this afternoon, according to the BBC. Now, the legislation, the EU withdrawal bill, as you know, has suffered 15 defeats in the House of Lords. The upper house sent the bill back to Parliament, defeating it on 15 areas. Not very good, this, is it? We talked a lot about this as well. Numbers are tight, says the BBC, because the Tories need the support of the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, for a majority. And Conservative MPs have been told to be on site at all times during the day of the votes. Right? Right? Okay. Peers have attempted to amend the EU withdrawal bill in several areas, including attempting to keep the country in the customs union. They've had a bit of a fracas over the Irish border, and they want to remove the precise date of Brexit. The date would be the 29th of March next year. The peers, the unelected peers, want to remove that date from the EU withdrawal bill wording. The amendments would also give Parliament a decisive say over Brexit and keep the European Union Charter of Fundamental Rights in force in the UK. Unelected peers. These are old fuddy-duddies. There's a word you haven't heard in a while. Who have to be woken up to go and vote on these amendments. Who've had to be woken up. Who've had to have the drool wiped off their chins and air freshener sprayed around them to kill the... No, I'm not going to say. They're old, but it doesn't mean they're incompetent. Fair enough. Now, Theresa May met with business leaders today. Number of business leaders from companies like GlaxoSmithKline, would you believe? And they rocked up at Downing Street today, and they are no doubt telling Theresa May in no uncertain terms that the UK should stay in the customs union, not leave it, and that we should continue to accept free movement of people here as well. Fascism you're living in, folks, fascism. Now, here's an interesting thing came up today. Sky News political editor Faisal Islam, he was reporting outside Number 10, so he was talking about these captains of industry who were meeting with May. And as he was talking about the captains of industry meeting May, Faisal Islam saw a letter from a government minister which seems to claim that the UK will accept alignment on VAT with the EU. A letter from a government minister that seems to say the UK will stay in a VAT area with the European Union. Now, this will piss off Brexiteers no end, because it's a massive concession, because setting your own competitive VAT rates, lowering it here and there, abolishing it here and there, whatever, was always seen as one of the great advantages of leaving the European Union. Here's what Faisal Islam had to say, and it is a bit of a bombshell.
I should say, on that issue, though, there is some emerging news, quite an intriguing, specific, technical bit of news about whether or not the United Kingdom will form part of the VAT rules of the European Union after Brexit. What's all that about, you might ask, particularly when the Vote Leave campaign said that part of the benefits of leaving the European Union would be to set our own VAT rates on fuel, lower the rates on, for example, sanitary products and the like. Well, it does appear that certainly the Treasury is pondering whether or not to be part of this EU VAT area for now. And a letter has emerged, I've got hold of it, from a Treasury minister in which it says, and there's a quote here I think that we've got, the government aims to keep VAT processes after EU exit as close as possible to what they are now. Which is interesting. No sense of cutting VAT on fuel, cutting VAT, the freedoms that you might get from the European Union. I think there are some Brexiters who will think this was the very point of Brexit. It looks like the Treasury are at least considering being part of this VAT area. That is the type of detail that businesses want to know, and perhaps we'll be asking the Prime Minister inside number 10 today.
Yes, and we'll get thoughts of Steve Keen, Professor Steve Keen, shortly. Interesting, said Faisal Islam. It isn't interesting. It should be a bombshell to the more than 17 million people who voted to leave. We're not going anywhere, ever. And this is a sad fact. It's a sad reality people are going to have to wake up to. More on the European Union with Steve Keen shortly. Now, Sajid Javid is the Home Secretary, recently appointed, of course, and today he outlined his new strategy or strategies to tackle extremism and terrorism in the UK. There are some very interesting things in amongst the raft of strategies announced by him. I'm going to read you a paragraph or two from Simon Jenkins writing in The Guardian today. Simon Jenkins writing an excellent article in The Guardian on the proposals or the strategy of Sajid Javid. So here's Simon Jenkins. He writes, the Home Secretary Sajid Javid has made an astonishing proposal among his strategies to be unveiled today. It is the personal information possessed by MI5 on some 20,000 British suspected citizens be declassified and shared with local authorities, police and others. This is in order to counter terrorism. There is no way such material can possibly stay secret. That's Simon Jenkins. So 20,000 suspected citizens will have information on them shared with local authorities, police and quote, others. Since nobody knows if they are on this list, writes Simon Jenkins, they have no way of countering or correcting false identification or information. No one giving information to the state, including possibly the identity of the giver, will be able to trust its secrecy. Indeed, if the list is not declared or even vetted, the suspicion must be that any MI5 intelligence on individuals will no longer be secret. This is not just a police state, but an insecure state. Parliament should demand instant clarification, he writes. He goes on to say, nothing is more dangerous to freedom than a new Home Secretary. He or she is bombarded with ideas from the backwoods of the security industry, ideas that failed to pass muster with his or her predecessors. The industry knows that the newcomer will be desperate to win headlines as, quote, tough on crime, end quote. It will push eagerly for new powers and new controls. Javid appears to have fallen at the first fence. Very good stuff from Simon Jenkins. Here is the Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, announcing these strategies today.
And we're going to start off by piloting in London, the West Midlands and Manchester. And just to sort of give a bit more sort of information on that, what it will mean is that in starting in those areas, it will be local agencies, so going beyond counter-terrorism policing, which you would normally have shared this type of data, so neighbourhood policing, local councils, my old department, CLG, because they work with councils, the Charity Commission, probation officers, so agencies like that, and sharing the information in a non-classified form. So that's important. So it will be sort of desensitized in a way, and it will be the sort of key bits of information that are required, like biographical information, so in a sort of declassified form. And that is also to sort of protect the nature of the data, but also, you know, if you don't need to know everything amongst the agency, then no need to share it, but enough just so that they can help. And then the idea is that this will probably be some of the people I referred to earlier, that the, I said there's approximately at the moment some 3,000 subjects of interest that the security services are sort of looking at each day. And there's also a further 20,000 of what they refer to as the closed subjects of interest, previously investigated but not anymore. Of that 20,000, I think there will always be, let's say, a few hundred that although they're sort of closed subjects, that at a local level, these agencies might be able to sort of help with them and maybe come up with an intervention program of some sort.
Did you understand any of that? I don't think anybody in attendance today had the first clue what Sajid Javid was talking about. Joe Pesci puts it best.
You know you're a lying, low-life, motherfucking gambling degenerate prick. You know that's what you are?
Pretty much. But when the draft of this was looked at, Simon Jenkins was able to pull it apart in The Guardian. And Jenkins went on to write today. Javid is now in danger of capitulating to terrorism's prime goal, which is to undermine the liberties and dignities of the state. Britain is utterly obsessed with terrorism, while far more frequent knife crimes are all but ignored. No city in Europe has been rendered as ugly as the West End of London, with its array of gates, barriers, bollards, and police armed with automatic weapons. Museums, shops, and sporting events must spend fortunes on security checks. At the entrance to Parliament, police are instructed to feel inside men's underpants. I know this from personal experience. That's an incredibly vivid picture of London. Now, I lived in London on two separate occasions over the years. My most recent visit to London was last November, and I was pretty stunned, it must be said, by the transformation in the city from the last time I lived there, which was in 2013, and last year, 2017. He's right. Gates, barriers, bollards, police with automatic weapons, and that is the definition. That's a kind of a Judge Dredd type reality, isn't it? A police state. That's what he's described. And Javid wants to share the details of 20,000 people without letting those people know that their details are being shared with local authorities, councils, police and others. They've talked today about employers. So your employer could be given a bit of information on you by maybe somebody is associated with MI5. Could be a teacher, could be somebody else. It is tyranny writ large. Do you remember Peter Kirkham? Peter is a former chief detective with the Metropolitan Police. He's been on with me several times. He was on Sky News today. This is what Peter Kirkham had to say about this.
But there's nothing wrong with asking the communities and businesses and other agencies and education and whatever to be eyes and ears. If we take away the terrorism label and say, if teachers are aware of some kids planning an armed robbery, nobody would say, oh, hang on a minute, it'd be wrong to tell the police that. If the police have got concerns about children being groomed into county lines drug gangs, everybody says, oh, we should share that with the teachers so that they can look out for the signs and they can work with those kids and stop them getting groomed into that. So as soon as we put this terrorism label, everybody seems to run about.
But what about the concerns of that there will be people, maybe even young people within that bracket, who are referred by a shopkeeper, a teacher, a headmaster, and they've not done anything wrong at all, and they're then in front of the police to answer some questions?
But that happens all the time. If we have any concerns about someone loitering outside the house next door where the occupants are on holiday, what do? We call the police. What do the police do? They turn up, have a word, and if there's no problem, there's no problem. If they're burglars sussing a place out, they get nicked.
Now, Peter Kirkham makes an interesting point there. But the presenter, who works for Sky News, because he's pretty incompetent, he's about as competent as a Nevada state boxing commissioner, should stop him and say, there's a huge difference between somebody loitering outside of a building and then being confronted by a police officer who was called by a neighbour. What's the huge difference? Well, the difference is the loiterer will know that they have been reported by somebody, and the police officer, the man or woman in uniform, will tell him or her what is going on. What Sajid Javid is proposing is that information be shared on 20,000 people listed as potentially dangerous, shared with everybody from the postman to the local head teacher to the butcher shop, you know, to the fishmonger, to everybody, without your knowledge, without you knowing that you're on that list and knowing why you were on that list, right? He should make that point, the presenter. He tries to play the devil's advocate with Peter Kirkham, but he doesn't make the salient point.
That's how policing operates, especially in a society like ours, where the police are the public and the public are the police. The eyes and ears of the police service are the public, and that's just what this is. My concern is that he hasn't addressed the ordinary police resources, the community policing resources, the community or the response policing resources, to do anything with this information
when
it comes
in. He says he will prioritise community policing in the next budget.
He says he will prioritise community policing in the next budget, but we'll see about that. Ultimately, policing has been underfunded for a number of years and across several governments in this country, because I believe ultimately the agenda is to privatise policing, even though that's something that Peter Kirkham disagreed with when he was on the programme, each of the two times he was on the programme with me. Moving on then, do I have time to do that story about schools? Not really. I'm running out of time here. A lot of people talked about this on social media today. A school in Oxfordshire has banned boys from wearing shorts in the very hot weather that we've been exposed to. And we're still being exposed. It's been wonderful, the weather, over the last few weeks. But a school in Oxfordshire has said, no, boys can't wear shorts, but they can wear skirts if they want. This is not a joke. Chiltern Edge Secondary School in Oxfordshire introduced this new uniform policy at the start of the academic year in an attempt to make the school's uniform more formal. Chiefs agreed the only legwear permitted on site would be trousers or skirts. So the school has stuck to their guns during the hot weather, refusing to allow boys to wear shorts, even if those shorts are tailored. But because this school had a bad rating, in an attempt to get a good rating, it's introduced gender-neutral policies. And the school, which is about to become an academy, which ultimately means it's going to be privatised, the school has said that boys could wear skirts instead, but not shorts. I don't have to say anything about that, do I? I know many of you listening to this now will have come across that story today. Today. And I've seen it on social media. Absolute incredulity expressed by people. They won't allow the kids to wear shorts, even if they're tailored and, you know, fit with the uniform, with the sweatshirt or whatever, the jumper, whatever. No, but you can wear skirts if you want. These are lunatic times. It's 23 minutes past the hour. We're going to get Professor Steve Keane on the line after these short messages. This is Monday's Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2, TuneIn Radio and TriggerWarning.tv.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
And it's fast approaching 25 minutes past the hour. Thanks for joining the programme. Lot of tweets on that school uniform story. It is a bit mad. William is listening in Scotland. He says if it's a kilt, then it's okay on Twitter. Do tweet the programme at Richie Allen Show. Let me know what you're thinking. Huge excitement about our first guest coming on the programme. I'm delighted that he's agreed to come back. He was on with me about this time last year, I think. I came across him back in 2008. Nobody made more sense to me when explaining the so-called financial crisis at that time, and I've been following him ever since. He's an economist, author, and he heads up the School of Economics, History and Politics at Kingston University in London. Delighted to welcome back Professor Steve Keane. Steve, welcome back. How are you?
Very good, Richie. Very good.
Thanks for doing it. Are you in Amsterdam as we speak? Because you mentioned
yes.
Amsterdam.
Yes, a long story, but I'm sort of living in both countries at the moment, and a whole lot of reasons why. I'll talk about them offline if necessary.
Yeah, lovely. Sounds good. Visited the city once. That was last year, and really enjoyed my time there. Mm. Now, our time, of course, is finite, so I won't waste it. When I announced you were coming on today, a lot of interest. Unsurprising that my listeners would be, of course, interested in you, of course, along with others. I said, what would you like me to put to Professor Steve Keane? Question number one, unsurprisingly, will the UK ever properly leave the European Union?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm somebody who voted for Brexit, not because I thought it'd be good for the European Union, but I thought I'd rather get out of a club I didn't want to be part of in the first place. And it'd be sensible to start making preparations for it to collapse, because I thought at some stage in the future it's inevitable that the euro will break up, and that will have to have cascading effects, of course, on the whole European Union program. But the capacity for the British ruling class to manage things in an incompetent fashion has convinced me that the very first show I saw when I came to the UK was actually a documentary. It was Monty Python's final show. And, I mean, Theresa, Cameron calling a referendum he intended to have lose, which won, which means he lost office, which May comes in. Corbyn comes in because of the Labour Party foolishly thinking that making the election democratic would ensure one of the Blairite candidates rather than a rebel. Like, I mean, and then the incompetence with which Brexit itself has been handled. Honestly, I mean, in some ways, one of the reasons I was delighted to consider living in Amsterdam rather than London, and I'm sick of getting Brexit on every conversation, like you got spam in that famous Monty Python skit.
Now, you said the negotiations have been mishandled by the government. Let me put this to you by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, writing in The Telegraph. Now, just for the sake of it, I'll remind our listeners, obviously Pritchard, Telegraph writer, is very much pro leaving, and he's very much anti, he's been an anti-European Union writer for a long time. But on the idea that the government is messing up things, he writes, about 3 weeks ago, he writes, the harsh truth is the government has drifted into a Greek Syriza trap, allowing itself to be beaten down by protracted talks on terms set entirely by Brussels. Such an imbalanced structure leaves Britain vulnerable to what traders call time decay, with a cliff edge drawing nearer. He basically says that the UK should have opted for WTO terms from the outset, reversing the roles, then Brussels would have had to come running, begging for an open trade deal. Is he right to say that these roadblocks and stumbling blocks are all coming from the side of Brussels?
Oh, yes, he's right that it was a deliberate policy by the Europeans to derail the Brexit vote. And this is exactly how they treated the vote for Syriza in Greece, and it's how they're treating, of course, they tried to treat the vote for the rebels in Italy, now the government in Italy. So they're not negotiating in good faith. And the very first mistake the British made was to agree to divorce settlement terms that affect the penalty to be paid before they agreed to the separation terms. It is like agreeing, this is what I'm going to pay my spouse on the divorce before you decide who gets the house and who gets the kids. It was just naive negotiation. That was my first sign they didn't know what the hell they were doing. And you also have to realize that the Maastricht Treaty, which formed the euro rather than the entire European Union, but that was written in such a way that there was no possibility of getting out. It was like basically an Irish wedding contract of 20 or 30 years ago. So there's no mechanism to begin with to get out of this arrangement. And the bureaucrats in Brussels were trying to make it as hard as possible anyway. But they virtually needn't have tried to because, again, the entire negotiation process has been so incompetent.
Yeah, it's been dreadful. We before we talk about Italy, because we've just briefly talked about Greece, I want to ask you another question about the UK. But on Greece, a lot of we've listeners right across Europe, and we hear from Greek people. I don't get very much right. I'm certainly not an economist. I wouldn't dare claim that I am. I'm a guy who reads a lot of financial publications, and I've read a lot of your work over the years. And it makes a lot of sense to me. I was kind of certain, and I did say it, and it's on record, it's the only thing I've ever gotten right, that Tsipras and the Greeks would capitulate in the end. I mean, they put the terms of the Troika bailout to the Greek people. They told the Greek people to reject it. They did, and then they capitulated. Why, Steve? Why did they capitulate?
I think I really highly recommend, if anybody wants to understand what the hell's going to go happen in Europe now with Italy, what's happening for the next 10 years and what the previous 20 years have been like, read Yanis Varoufakis's Adults in the Room. It's a wonderful expose of what it was like to be finance minister for Greece and the way he was treated by all the various negotiators for the European Union. And it includes transcripts of recordings he basically illegally recorded, put them entirely verbatim in the book, and he's basically saying, so sue me, and nobody's dared sue him so far, so you can trust all the conversation there as being gospel truth as to what actually happened. And they really just tortured the Greek negotiators right from the outset, telling them, quote-unquote by Schäuble, again in the book, that political elections should not be able to interfere with economic policy. Notice that interfere. In other words, economic has primacy over politics. And that, again, is the nature of the way the European Union was formed, because many people would say that the rise of the Nazis, the Great Depression, the Second World War were due to bad political choices. That's the way economists actually interpreted it. And in many ways, they'd like to have politics taken out of economics and given over to the hands of the experts, which, of course, are the neoclassical economists. And look what a fine job they've done. Now, of course, having designed something like the euro, which was on a hiding to nothing to fail, they're just not about to admit that it's going to fail, so they basically torture anybody who wants to leave. And finally, that particular referendum, I had heard scuttlebutt that when Tsipras called it, he was, again, like Cameron, hoping it would lose. That's verified again in Yanis's book, because Yanis was euphoric that the populace had voted 60% to reject the European Union's terms. He ran into Tsipras's office jubilant and found himself in a room of depressed people. So they were, and then of course what Tsipras did was just basically he'd hoped to hand it over to the Greek people, have the Greek people tell him, yes, accept the terms. He'd go along and reluctantly have to accept the terms. Instead, he did the Stockholm Syndrome thing of ignoring what his own people said and falling over to what Merkel and Schäuble were putting him through. And you've seen the state of Greece as a result of that for the last 3 years.
So it should have defaulted, it should have left, and it should have introduced the drachma, even though it wouldn't have been worth anything. But it should have started again.
It was quite a drachma. What was actually proposed, and again, this is well worth reading Arnold's book to see what's going on. There's a set of IMF bonds, which themselves were not particularly important, but part of the IMF's charter is such that it's not allowed to give loans when it has no expectation of them given back. It got strong-armed in being part of the Troika by the European Union. So what Yanis had as a trigger was, first of all, to say we're going to default on the IMF bonds, which would then cause a cascade effect of causing the European Central Bank bonds to fail, which would have brought QE to its knees. So it was one hell of a weapon. And then at the same time to bring in a tax credit system, rather like the mini-bots, which is being spoken about by the Italians as a potential parallel payment system, not actually a currency, but a payment system. That was all ready to go. Now, Yiannis is a very strong belief in democracy. You can see that how he sworn DiEM25. He had the capacity, he had the right delegated to him by Tsipras to say, we're going to pull the trigger in one of the meetings of the finance ministers. And in a chapter titled in the book, Mea Maxima Culpa, for those who know their Latin, for those who don't, my most grievous fault, he decided not to pull the trigger, but to go and see Tsipras and get Tsipras to pull the trigger, and Tsipras declined.
That's very interesting, that. We'll leave Greece for now, because I've been very critical of, not personally, of course, you wouldn't expect that, but I've been very critical of the actions of Yiannis Varoufakis during that period. And you've presented a fairly balanced argument against my thoughts that basically he ran away from the Greeks at their, you know, at their worst possible time, rather than face down these.
Read the book, mate. Read the book.
Yeah, I'll have a look at it. Yeah.
I've known him for 25 years. He's been a friend for that length of time. Yeah. And one thing I was reading the book, one thing I was looking for was to see whether he would say, I made a mistake at any point and what that mistake was. That was the one I was expecting to see. That's what he said. He regrets the decision. But, of course, given his combination of things, strong belief in democracy and always a willingness to try to work things through, that made him make that decision and not to pull the trigger. As I said in my review, I would like to think that I would pull the trigger myself had I been in the same situation, but I wasn't there and he was. And it's a very, very different thing to be on the line in a situation like this, to being commenting from the outside, thinking, hypothesizing what you might do if you were in those circumstances.
Fair enough, Steve. Professor Steve Keane is our guest. Check out Debunking Economics if you haven't read it before. It's a fascinating, really insightful read. And it's very reader friendly. I have to say that. It really is, you know. For people sometimes get a bit, I used to shake my head when anybody, when the subject of economics came up. But do check it out, and Steve's other books as well. Live on the line to us from Amsterdam. Absolute craziness, chaos going on in Italy at the moment. Liga and Five Star have, it seems, formed a government. Well, it's imminent anyway. How long that government lasts is another thing. Interestingly enough, it's been reported that people like Luigi Di Maio is a moderate, despite some of the things he said about the single currency and about the European Union, that he might be a moderate, that, you know, these guys might have very, very drastic plans for the country. How radical are these guys really, do you think, Steve, in Italy? And what's to say that they won't abandon the promises they made in their manifesto when they come under the sorts of pressure we've just been talking about?
Well, in fact, I'm quite impressed with how they handled themselves so far, because the sticking point was Savona, I think the Savona or Savoni, the 81-year-old professor of economics who was actually the person who developed Italy's first econometric model of its own economy, who'd worked for the Treasury, worked for the Central Bank, was chief of a small business lobby in the country, ran a bank. He was blocked by the Prime Minister. Why? Because he said we need contingency plans in case the euro fails. And he worked out the idea of the mini-bot. Now, if it had been the Tsipras style of negotiating, where the relevant authorities said, no, you can't have that person, there may have been a decision, oh, okay, who else do you want? But what they actually said was, no, we resign, we're not going to form a government. And that then put the other side on the back foot. And finally, they've come back. Savona is now in the ministry. He's not as finance minister. I think he's an economic minister or some other position. But it means he will have a say in how the Italians react to any negotiations they have to do through the finance ministry, a cabal, which by far is the most dominant political grouping in the European Union. So I think they're handling themselves fairly well so far. But, of course, there's an enormous difference on social policy between the two wings. And there's a strong, as Yiannis pointed out in one of his most recent blogs, a strong racist element too to the position of the Northern League about the immigration. Because, again, we all know Italy is copping the largest number, by the looks of it, of migrants coming across from Africa.
So is it a bit unfair then to say racist, Steve? I mean, I get this all. I've used the term racist before. I'm categorised as some sort of socialist, but I don't identify as anything. I just have opinions. Is it a bit unfair because that immigration has caused massive problems in terms of its effect on public services? And is it easy, and I don't mean for you, but for everybody, is it easy to just label people as racist when they talk about the effect that immigration has on public services?
Yeah, that's one potential interpretation. I definitely don't know the parties involved. I could actually meet up and say, yeah, they're racist. from my own personal dealings. If I ever did meet them, I could come away and say, no, they're people who are feeling the pressure of, you know, massive extra numbers. We really don't know. But certainly the we're going to face enormous migration of people being forced by military conflicts in the south, in the Arabian area, and by climate failure in north of Africa in the next 20 or 30 years. And, of course, that puts enormous pressure on social cohesion, on social services and so on. So it's it's not amazing you get a knee-jerk reaction to it.
Funnily enough, you described there a second ago kind of an attempted coup by the EU on Italy by refusing Paolo Savona, or at least telling the president that Paolo Savona was unacceptable. The finance minister would be Professor Giovanni Tria. I don't know how much you know. You might know him, in fact, but he must be a reader of your work, Steve, because he's basically said, give at any opportunity over the years, looking into his background in the last few days, that Germany has basically used the single currency to lock in for them an advantage over everybody else in Europe, running a current account surplus of 8.5% of GDP at the expense of everybody else in Europe, which basically screws, not to put too fine a point on it, everybody in the south. That's something you've been talking about for a long, long time. How does that work in layman's terms? Can you explain that in a way that our listeners will understand it?
Simple side, but imagine you've got two countries that agree to share a currency where one has a slightly higher inflation rate than the other. What that means is over time, one country's goods are getting cheaper compared to the other country. But that's what's been happening with Greece versus Italy. And the difference is trivial. I actually got quite a surprise when I saw the data just recently. The average annual rate of inflation in Italy since the euro was formed is just below 2%, about 1.9% per annum. That's a very low rate of inflation, the sort of thing you'd think, yeah, that's actually below the target that central banks hit. Well, Germany's hit 1.4%, which is lower still. In fact, that's at a level now where central banks are trying to increase inflation above that level. When you compound that virtually 0.5% per annum difference in prices over the 20 years or so that the euro has been in existence, what that means is that German prices are 10% lower than Italian prices. Now, consequently, a Mercedes-Benz with comparable price to a Lamborghini when the euro was formed is now 10% cheaper than the Lamborghini. And that keeps on happening. German goods are cheaper than Italian goods. Italians will tend to buy more German goods than Italian goods. You start getting a trade deficit coming out of that, favouring deficit out of Italy, surplus for Germany, and that in turn means that German firms are financing their investment courtesy of their trade surplus, which means they can actually continue getting ahead of Lamborghini, which doesn't get the same investment funds. So it's a problem which compounds on itself. The simple way out of it is to devalue your currency by 10%. Ha-ha,
you can't
because you both use the euro.
Because you're in the euro. That was obviously a deliberate thing. I mean, I get a lot
I wouldn't say it's conspiratorial, but what I say is you never sign a pact with somebody about, you know, let's go jumping in the ocean if the person you're going to jump in the ocean actually enjoys cold water. Now, that is the case with Germany. Germany is terrified of inflation after the Weimar Republic experience. Even though they agreed that the agreed target for the Eurozone was a 2% per annum rate of inflation, Germany, even though it was well below the 2%, continued putting pressure on its trade unions not to negotiate for wage rises. So there's been a lower rate of inflation in Germany because wage rises haven't been sufficient to keep up with the cost of living there. They've been, the German workers have been losing out. So that's the Germans wanting more pain on a low rate of inflation and willing to inflict it on their working class. And the impact of that is destabilized the Eurozone. If they'd agreed to and stuck to the 2% target, and Italy by far came closest to that target, then there would not have been this drift, there would not have been the trade balance differences as well. So the Germans caused this. The mistake is holding hands with somebody who enjoys cold water.
And for everybody in Europe, that means essentially that, love him or loathe him, and I think it might be the latter for you, when people like Nigel Farage use terms like fascist dictatorship, he's right. It is a fascist dictatorship.
Well, it's a dictatorship in the sense that it's been a set of rules that are set up that mean you can't change the rules. And whether the rules make sense or not, you've got to execute the rules. Now, what was the excuse of the Nuremberg trials? I was simply following orders.
Yeah.
Well, it's not quite the same thing, obviously, but nonetheless, if you have a set of rigid rules which do not work, which numerous critics have said before it happened and have said after, it's not going to work, it's going to break down. You continue making those rules apply, you are causing social breakdown, supposedly in the name of economic progress.
Steve Keane is our guest. We've got Steve for another 5 or 6 minutes. He's coming up for 16 minutes to the top of the air. It's your Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2. Tune in, of course, as well. Trigger warning and richieallen.co.uk. Now, the Labour movement under Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, I know you support some of their ideas. I certainly support the renationalisation of vital public services. I do. That's why I get called a socialist, of course, but I really do believe in that. It's where I come from. I come from a trade union background. But those ideas seem to be contradictory. They're not compatible with Corbyn and McDonnell wanting to stay in some sort of customs union. There's a lot of contradictory policies coming out of the Labour Party. What do you think about some of these policies?
Oh, I think, well, the things like renationalisation of the railways and things like that.
Yeah.
There should be no difficulty in doing it because, of course, the ironic thing is that most of those privatised railways, excepting Virgin, of course, are owned by European rail companies, which are government-owned. So there's no problem saying we're going to go back to government ownership here. We'll just hand back the shares to the European nationally owned railway systems that own and are not investing in British rail. So I think there's a fair bit of room to do what they want to do. It's interesting to the extent to which the European Union does not enforce its rules unless the finance minister's cabal decide it's a good idea to do it. Because, for example, Italy's government debt-to-GDP ratio, which I don't think should matter, the euro has made these things important, that began at almost twice the maximum level allowed under the rules of the Maastricht Treaty. And it hasn't been mentioned at all until suddenly they have a left-wing government again. Now they're talking about their debt being too high, private government debt being too high. So the European Union very selectively enforces its own rules.
Couple of quick questions, Steve. What about the idea for a national investment bank? There hasn't been so much talk of that from the Labour Party of late. But this is one of the big things they talked about before the last election. I would have thought any national investment bank is going to have to be capitalised by the Central Bank of England, which is capitalised by the European Central Bank. So you're still looking at...
No, it's not. That's one of the few things you can say in favour of British politics is deciding not to join the euro. So the Bank of England can do whatever it wants because it's the only monopoly producer of British pounds. So there's no problem about the British Central Bank, capitalising a national investment corporation in Britain.
Okay, but they would still be borrowing from that Central Bank of England.
One of the mistakes we make is thinking people borrow from overseas because they need to borrow overseas to produce local currency. You don't borrow overseas because you need to produce local currency using it. You borrow overseas because you're running a trade deficit. And your customers need to have American dollars or European euros to buy goods, and you're selling it to them. So the borrowing, you don't need to borrow anything from anywhere to create British pounds.
Help me out here then, because the country is running a massive deficit, a borrowing deficit. It borrows. Governments must borrow from the Central Bank of England to pay for its running the government, right? It does borrow from the Central Bank of England. That's how it works.
Indirectly, but if you had a backup Bank of Ritchie and you could borrow from the Bank of Ritchie, and anybody accepts the bills issued by the Bank of Ritchie in full payment of any contract you had with the company Ritchie, would you be worried?
Yes, but it doesn't work like that in reality, because in reality
it does work like that in reality with a central bank.
But not in this country, it doesn't, because...
Well, put it this way. You have your central bank has financed £200 billion worth of quantitative easing purchases of bonds off the finance sector for the last decade. Where in your tax return have you seen you're paying for QE? The answer is you haven't. The Bank of England simply credits the accounts for the financial institutions with the bonds they're wanting to buy for £200 billion. And puts that as an asset on its asset side of its books. It's now got £200 billion worth of bonds. It's simply accounting. And in a very roundabout way, the same thing applies to the borrowing by the Treasury. If that is financed by the central bank, it's all accounting operations inside the central bank.
explain to me and to our listeners then, obviously the Labour Party is hugely popular. Jeremy Corbyn is a big movement of younger people because austerity measures enforced by the last coalition government and this government have obviously hit services right across the board here to pay down the deficit. To who? Who's the money owed to?
Oh, well, this is the thing. You don't actually have to. What the money is a record of government money creation over the previous couple of centuries. Because when you have the government creating money, if you could possibly directly borrow from the central bank, and it's not possible to do that because of laws which have been put in place to stop it, but technically it's possible to do that. What happens is the Treasury works out what it thinks its tax revenue is going to be for the next year, works out what its spending is likely to be, issues bills for the difference. In a very roundabout way, they could probably sell those bills to the Bank of England. The Bank of England says, okay, we'll buy those bills off you. We'll put a creditor for that exactly same amount in your treasury account. You can now spend. So in that sense, the change in government debt is a record of government money creation. The indirect way that it goes about means that actually it takes money which gets stuck in the financial sector and siphons it back into the real economy when they sell the bonds not to the central bank but to private financial institutions. But fundamentally, if you go the whole hog of the central bank buying 100% of those bonds that are issued by the Treasury, sold to the financial sector, the central bank bought all those bonds off the financial sector, that would be creating money, and the record of the change in government debt, which would all be debt the Treasury would then owe to the central bank, which of course is like Richie owing to Richie, that is simply a record of the amount of money that's been created that particular year.
So why the austerity to why screw people to the wall to pay back a debt that doesn't need to be paid back then?
For the same reason people used to worry about epicycles and things like that. It's understanding how the world operates, which is plausible and fundamentally wrong. There's no necessity for the government to even issue a bond to finance its own operations, so long as the money issued by a central bank is accepted as money in its realm. And, of course, people have to accept the pound when it's tended to buy anything anywhere in the UK. So what people have done is they've used an analogy about what it would be like if a household was spending more than it got back and apply that to an entire country. Now, that is completely the wrong frame of reference. It's like trying to understand the solar system by assuming Earth is the centre and the sun and the moon and stars revolve around us. It's going to be a neat, plausible and totally wrong theory of how the universe operates. The same story about saying the government is like a household. If it's like a household, where's your central bank?
Yeah, let me go all
the wrong analogy.
Let me go all conspiratorial on you then, just for the last 90 seconds or so, right? Because I love this. So the result of this lunacy then that we're talking about is the sale of everything of any real value to massive corporations and private interests. So you don't have to be Lieutenant Columbo to realise that this system is enforced by those who want to transfer real wealth, real assets into the hands of a tiny few.
That is one way to interpret it. And it's not, right. I'm not going to jump on it as a conspiracy theory, it doesn't make sense, but the conspiracy
it's the
theory
truth,
doesn't
right?
make sense.
Yeah.
But it's one of those, it's a plausible fallacy, which is useful for those who want to take over privately owned assets and make them privately owned. But it is still a fallacy. And ironically, it actually ends up debilitating the wealthy to do it as well. They might get the ownership of the assets, but the country itself grows more slowly. They'd be wealthier if they weren't so damn greedy.
I've been asked to ask you, this will be the final question, and it'll be the second last one because I want to hear about this documentary that you're involved in. I can't wait for that, by the way. Second last question then, where does the Bank for International Settlements come into that? If it's basically, because as I understand it, it's a bank for the central bank, so it capitalises or it funds to some degree central banks.
The BIS... I don't actually know the history of the BIS as well as I should, but I know it well enough to say that it fundamentally operates as a talking fest for the central banks of the world. There may have been a clearinghouse role at some stage, but even though it's called the Bank of International Settlements, it doesn't particularly do them. And in fact, the Bank of International Settlements research staff have been about the only ones worth reading from the whole official family, the IMF, the World Bank, et cetera, et cetera. Bill White, who was the research director when the financial crisis was underway and before it happened, was the only person in a formal position using Hyman Minsky's theories and warning about an approaching crisis. And he was doing it quite literally in the face of Alan Greenspan. So the BIS is actually one of the organisations I have a lot of time for.
Final question then. Good to have you back, by the way. You were fundraising on Thursday for a new documentary on inequality under capitalism. Tell us a bit about that and tell us where people can find it.
I was just basically helping out because they got in touch with me and asked would I help promote it with my Twitter following and so on. And so I was happy to do it because I liked what they were trying to do. Unfortunately, they began with a conspiracy theory and a mathematically invalid theory of why financial systems drive us into economic crises. The idea that if you borrow money, because the government, the bank gives you the money but not the money to pay the interest, that necessarily compounds, that's a mathematical fallacy. And one of the reasons I designed the Minsky software is to make it easy to establish that to people. So the documentary itself, I've been in touch with me. I actually stood up and said, look, here's who I am. I'm the world expert on what you've just said at the beginning of this documentary, and you're wrong. And I'm hoping they'll get in touch with me and we can actually rewrite the documentary because the reason debt compounds has got far more to do with people's investment behavior and decisions under uncertainty than it has with the simple idea that interest compounds and makes debt get bigger.
Do me a favor, come back in the autumn and talk to me in the autumn briefly about creating money out of thin air, not creating interest, because you said it's a fallacy. A lot of our listeners would be horrified to hear that because they're absolutely committed to that understanding that
well, banks... money is created out of thin air in the sense that money doesn't come out of a bucket.
No.
Money is created by accounting and it is in that sense thin air. And I'm quite happy to talk about the mechanics behind it and why in some circumstances and almost all the time, in fact, you'll get a financial crisis out of it over the long term. Happy to do that.
Great for you to come back, Steve. I really appreciate it. Loved hearing from you again. Thanks for coming on the programme and continued success to you. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Richie. Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Professor Steve Keane, live on the line to us there from Amsterdam. Check out Debunking Economics if you haven't before. And you'll find Steve, he blogs a lot and he appears in a lot of newspapers as well, writing about these issues. It's exactly 4 minutes to the top of the hour. We're going to take a very quick break. Back with more in a minute. Your comments. Don't forget Jeff Berwick joins the programme a bit later on as well.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Right, welcome back. Monday's programme, 2 minutes to the top of the hour. Jeff Berwick joins me in a few minutes' time. Hi to Tony Allars. Made that comment about the Bank of International Settlements even. Tony, it's the central bank's bank. And yeah, I would have a lot to say about the Bank of International Settlements. Didn't have time to get into it in great detail, but it's I suppose it's like the head of the five families in terms of, if you see these institutions as mafia organisations, which they are, the Bank for International Settlements is at the head of it, really. A lot of guests who've come on this programme before have written extensively about it, and the Rothschilds and the Warburgs and the Rockefellers and all the rest of that. These are things we get into a lot, obviously, in the programme. Check out richieallen.co.uk, richieallen.podomatic.com for archives or archived editions of this programme as well. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take some music. Very warm again, very humid in the old studio. Can't have the windows open, sadly. But it's very warm, so we've got some music then while I get a cold drink, an non-alcoholic cold drink, a cold glass of water. One. Here's some Prince. This is Raspberry Beret on the Richie Allen Show. Raspberry Beret on the Richie Allen Show, live from Manchester. This Monday, it's the 4th of June 2018. Always enjoy speaking with Professor Steve Keane. Remember, after the what I would say was the inevitable and the manufactured crisis of 2008, I remember hearing him on radio for the first time. I hadn't come across Steve before. I'd heard of him, of course, I'd heard his name mentioned, but I'd never interviewed him. But he talked at length at that time about how it was absolutely the wrong thing to bail out reckless and criminal financial institutions. I don't know if Steve used those adjectives to describe the banks at the time. Those are my words. But he did say that the people should have been bailed out. People, ordinary men and women and small businesses should have been bailed out, not the financial institutions of the world. And It's difficult when you're a layman or a lay person, as I am. It's difficult to, not because I've argued with Steve Keane. I've had Steve Keane on the programme last year and I argued with him about money creation and whom it benefits and who creates it and to what end. But I'm obviously not an economist, and I haven't written books about money. But he said something very interesting there, did Steve, about the necessity or the lack of necessity for UK governments to pay back money that it has created for the purposes of running the country, of running the government, paying for the spending plans of the government. He said it's unnecessary. And I said to him, well, the only reason that that system would be enforced then, basically, oh, we owe a load of money, and in order to pay it back or pay it down, we need to imposition the worst off in society with austerity measures, and we have to sell the real assets, the real wealth of the country to multinational companies or to private interests. We've got to sell that in order to help pay down the deficit. And I said to him, that obviously results in everybody else getting extremely poor or continuously poor, or what, a tiny, 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 tiny elite gets everything. And said, whether you think it's conspiratorial or not, that's what happens. So you have to draw the logical conclusion that the system was designed to do that very thing. And he didn't deny it, effectively. And to David Stanford and to everybody else, I say we're bridging gaps. Because ultimately I want people, a lot of our listeners come from a background where they get their information all the time from the Daily Mail, or they get it from the Telegraph, or they get it from the Guardian, or they get it from the BBC. A lot of our listeners are new to the sorts of thinking that we explore on this programme. Who would do that? Who would create effectively a Hunger Games society? And why? The why is obviously massive. Why would they do that? Why would Jeremy Corbyn not come out and say, we don't need to be paying back the Bank of England? As Steve said, it's effectively Richie borrowing from the Bank of Richie. That's how it should be, but of course that's not how it is. Right? As he said right there, you take in taxation, enormous amounts of taxation, and you offset that against what you need, what you actually need. What's the surplus? So I take in all this taxation. Right, how much do I need now to pay for running the country, to keep the NHS just above water, and all the other things that we need to do, roads, everything else, everything that you need to do to run a country. Right, we've got taxation. Oh, but we still need, well, we still need another 5 billion. We need another 20 billion pounds. We'll borrow it. From who? These are things I've been talking about for years. These are the things I want people to take on board for the first time. New converts to the Richie Allen Show and to shows like this. What's going on? Who put that system in place? And why did they do that? Because the result of it is, well, we talk about it all the time. People getting poorer and poorer and poorer. People being left with nothing. Nowhere for people to live. More and more people homeless. People out of work. Who benefits? You heard it from the horse's mouth there. There's no need for any government to be borrowing from an institution that it owns, or that it is supposedly in control of, to pay for the running of the country. This is where I disagree with Steve. But I don't have the abject proof. I don't have the definitive, you know, Lieutenant Colombo, here's the proof. But we know it's true. We know that there are other nameless people way above the pay grade of David Cameron and Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May saying this is the way it's going to be. Right. Jeff Berwick is standing by. Let's get Jeff on. Shall we? Yeah, we'll get Jeff. We're going to take some more music while we get Jeff on. That's what we're going to do. Keep the tweets coming in, by the way. A lot of tweets on this. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. At Richie Allen Show on Twitter. And if you want to see what other people are tweeting me, simply, it couldn't be any easier, in fact, put Richie Allen Show, all one word, where it says search Twitter, press enter, and you can see what people are tweeting me and engage them then. You can have a chat with them. You can agree with them, disagree with them, or whatever, right? This is music from Blur on Your Richie Allen Show. Goes back to 1994, I think. 93, 94. Song called There's No Other Way. Jeff Berwick is standing by in Acapulco. He joins me in a minute. Right, let's get rid of that then. It's 9.5 minutes, nearly 10 minutes past the hour of the Richie Allen Show for Monday, June 4th, 2018. My next guest needs very little introduction. He's been on the programme many times before. Top man. He is very well known to you. He's an entrepreneur, very successful man, libertarian, anarcho-capitalist, and runs a fantastic annual event in Acapulco called Anarchapulco. Hugely popular, where a lot of like-minded people come together with ideas and with plans to, I suppose, to bring down this cabal, or at least to raise awareness of what's really going on. He is none other than the dollar vigilante himself. Let's welcome back Jeff Berwick to the programme. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you, Richie. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for coming on again. Great to be with you. Loads to talk about today. Trade wars, the European Union. I had Steve Keane, the professor of economics from Kingston University, on the programme in the first hour. I'll ask you the question I asked him. Will the United Kingdom ever leave the European Union, Jeff?
Well, as you know, Richie, I've been covering that quite a bit with the Brexit and all that. And I was really shocked when they allowed the vote to go through for Brexit, because virtually every major election, I just call them selections, are completely organized and co-opted to get the results that they want. And I was pretty sure that the powers that shouldn't be, the globalists, whatever you want to call them, did not want Brexit to happen. But when I saw that they allowed it to happen, it made me realize that they were under so much pressure. There was so much, so many people that were really upset about this and really wanted to leave the European Union, that they decided that in order to keep people somewhat pacified, that they would allow the vote to go through. And as soon as that happened, I said, what will probably happen now is that it really won't happen in any respect. It will go on for years and years, and it will never actually happen, but it will actually just pacify enough people for a few years to think that, oh, maybe we do have some power. Maybe our vote means something, which it absolutely doesn't. This is all just a game. All democracy is just a game to make people think that they have some sort of role in all of these things, or have some sort of say. It's just for show. The same people stay in power no matter what happens. And that's what we've seen in the UK. We've seen the prime murderer, the prime minister there, talking about not wanting to Brexit. We've seen how it's all been slowed down and how this is going to take years and years. So at this point, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I was totally expecting this, that it would not happen easily or overnight or even possibly at all.
Good stuff, Jeff. I should have mentioned that. To be fair to you, you did say that back in 2016. You said you thought they'd allowed it to happen, to then later on, after a couple of years or 3 years, to say, look, we won't, we can't leave, or we shouldn't leave. Things have changed. People have a different opinion. Let's have another vote or whatever. But it seems right across Europe, and again, speaking with Steve Keane in the first hour about this, we've seen what's happened in Italy, obviously, in the last few months. Finally, it seems the Liga and Five Star movement in Italy, which are anti-European Union and pro-nationalist parties, seem to be about to form a government there. Hungary, other parts of the continent, we're seeing anti-European Union, pro-nationalist sentiment being expressed. What are they going to do, Jeff? What do you expect that those behind the European Union are going to do to try and put this down, this, you know, this kind of rising tide of anti-European Union sentiment?
Well, as I mentioned, they do have to at least listen a little bit to what people want, because if literally 90% of people in the UK want to exit from the European Union, and it's very obvious, they can't just force it without doing a number of things. And what they're doing and have been doing is slowing it down bureaucratically or bureaucratically. They've been using tons of media. They control the media. All mainstream media is essentially propaganda, especially there in the UK, where you have literally the government's media channel, the BBC, which puts out, you know, whatever they want to put out that serves their purposes. So they've been putting out lots of that. I've seen lots of things about how dangerous it would be and how there is so much support for staying in the EU now and all that sort of thing. That's all the propaganda that they can use. But the other part of this whole thing is the people that are in control, the power structure, so, or whatever you want to call it, they really like division and people fighting over things, because as long as you can keep people divided on any topic, and that's what they do, they find almost every topic and try to keep people fighting over it, whether it be anything really, gay marriage or anything at all. They'll try to put out as many things as possible to get enough people fighting, because if people are in a constant state of essentially fighting each other and sort of this fear state that, well, what if the other side gets in and they enforce their views using violence through government on me, that they can essentially keep this game going, because no one's really focusing on the real issue, which is who's really in charge and what's really going on. And the fact that we're all slaves, if you're extorted or taxed in any way, you're a slave. And they don't want anyone really ever realizing that. So they'll keep these battles going. This is all meant to keep us all incredibly busy, when really, at the end of the day, we're all just human beings and we should just have free trade amongst one another. That's the basic thing that we should have, and we shouldn't be extorted, which is taxes, and we shouldn't be told what to do by people using guns, which is government. And so as long as they can keep everyone in a constant state of division, then they can keep this game going, and they'll play both sides very often. They'll let one side win every now and then. That sort of is what happened with Donald Trump in the US. They do this all the time. They put in someone who's really extreme right, like George Bush, who does his family does things like 9/11, and a lot of people get really upset. Oh, he's so right. We need someone really left. And then they bring in Barack Obama, who was essentially raised in a test tube by Henry Kissinger, as far as I can tell. No one actually knows where he's from. No one really saw him until he became president. And then all the right people said, oh my gosh, this guy's too left. We need a right. And so they go, okay, let them win this time. So they give Trump. But nothing actually changes. You look at the U.S. presidency as a great example. There's been no change. George Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump have all done the exact same things. There's little things they do that are different, and it's a lot of the, you know, the way they talk and things like that, but everyone's still getting extorted. The IRS is still extorting most people for trillions of dollars per year. The wars continue despite how much Barack Drone Bomber talked about peace before he became president and was given the Nobel Peace Prize, which was, is a total sham. And he had not one day of peace his entire presidency, but because he was left, all of a sudden all the anti-war people went, okay, so it's good bombs. I think he's even got a Netflix special coming out called Bombs of Peace.
He does.
It's so Orwellian. It's unbelievable.
That's right. As far as I understand, Obama and his wife have been commissioned to make films or to make a series by Netflix. It's quite extraordinary. What you said about left versus right, alt-right versus alt-left, and identity politics is absolutely spot on. Let me put you on the spot just for a second. How do you extricate people from that? I'll give you an example, Jeff, while you're thinking about that. We reported on the imprisoning of, let's call him a right-wing activist called Tommy Robinson here in the UK. He used to be a football hooligan. I'm not trying to kick the guy when he's down now. Just trying to remind our listeners who this guy is. And then he tried to rebrand himself as a journalist, which is laughable. I become very snobbish when people try to call themselves journalists, because I am a journalist. And you know, I'm a real journalist. And it pees me off when activists call it, because activist or activism journalism is an oxymoron anyway. But anyway, this guy Robinson, for me, Robinson is just another version of what you described there. He's just another identity, far right versus far left. And people flock to that in their droves. for whatever reason, they're looking for answers or because people are saying things that they identify with. And I see that, Jeff, and I've been covering news, politics, geopolitics for the best part of 20 years. And I see this mindset getting worse and worse and worse. Rather than people actually see that what you said is 100% right, it's a rigged game, it's ridiculous, it doesn't matter who you vote for, nothing is going to change, in fact it's going to get worse. It seems people embed themselves more now than ever with their side. You know, I'm a socialist, I'm a liberal, I'm a conservative. How do we extricate ourselves from it, Jeff? What do you do to get out of that mindset?
It is very difficult. Essentially, what's happened is generations of brainwashing. It is literally brainwashing of the population into believing in this left-right phony paradigm that keeps people completely divided at all times. If you even look back at the founding of the U.S. with the founding fathers, as cultish as that sounds, that essentially was, people trying to get away from the UK, but they just started up their own sort of thing. But even if you look at the founding fathers, not many of them liked democracy at all. In fact, democracy is one of the most worst forms of government there is. Of course, all forms of government are bad, but democracy is especially nefarious because it gives people, you hear people say it all the time. They say, when, for example, if the U.S. bombs Libya for no reason except for to install a central bank, a lot of people in the U.S. will go, "We bombed Libya." No, you didn't. You didn't do anything.
Yeah.
But they get them to buy in that this is us and we do this and you have a say. Absolutely not. Nothing that any government does for the most part has anything to do with what the people want. And we see that constantly. And people are starting to wake up to that. But yes, they're really pushing us as hard as they can now, this left-right thing, because they want everyone in complete chaos, almost civil war style in the U.S., almost civil war style, maybe even there in the U.K. I've seen just this week more of the right people getting really angry about what's going on. And, of course, the left, they're always angry about what's going on. So they want this all the time. As far as waking people up, and you have to remember, like, they literally from the time you're born, you're being indoctrinated into this cult. It's called a culture, but it's literally a cult, and every country has it. So a lot of people will laugh at North Korea and North Koreans and say, "Oh, I can't believe they believe Lil Kim is some sort of savior and all this sort of thing." Well, if you talk to your average American, they've got Donald Trump there on the wall in the government indoctrination camps, which they call schools, where they do their Pledge of Allegiance every day. And they believe generally the same thing, that the government and the president are here to protect us and save us. It's all a scam. So as far as waking people up, it's very difficult. Obviously, you're talking about deprogramming brainwashed people, and we're talking about hundreds of millions, if not billions, on Earth who are literally brainwashed. But they're starting to wake up thanks to the internet, thanks to just seeing how this is going. We have enough evidence and information now to show that no matter what it is, left or right, it's bad. We need to get rid of these big governments in general and live peacefully amongst each other and not be enforcing our views upon each other through so-called voting and being in a constant state of division. But we are seeing, like, for me personally, Richie, you know, I run Anarchapoco. We're going into our fifth year next year. It's doubled in size every year. People are waking up to it. And in fact, I don't know if you even know this, but David Icke's speaking next year in 2019.
Oh,
I'm really
excited
stuff. About that.
Really good. And, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, and he, you know, with David Icke, as you know, what the stuff he was talking about 10 or 20 years ago, most people thought he was crazy. Even myself, as awake as I appear to be now, and I'm still waking up, I was like, he seems a little crazy. This is crazy stuff he's talking about. But every year that passes, you see all the stuff that he was talking about being proven as being true. And that's generally happening with sort of liberty movement in general, is people have been listening to us and thinking we're crazy, the more anarchist, the more voluntarist, the people who don't want to force our views on other people, sort of like Jesus, do unto others as you want them to do unto you. They thought we were crazy. But as every year passes and they see how crazy it gets and gets crazier and crazier, some people are starting to wake up and realize maybe the answer isn't voting in government for your views, whether it be left or right. Maybe the answer is to shut down central banks and governments, and then we'll have peace and prosperity on Earth like we've never known it.
Yeah, I love that. I love listening to that. But then I see Trump fans, and I understood why a lot of people, I called myself a bit of a snob earlier, but in reality, I'm not. And when people voted for Trump, even though I knew better, which is very arrogant, even though I knew better, I kind of understood, you know, the Clinton crime cartel and everything that went with that and Obama. And then Trump came along and he appeared to be different and new. And he said some very exciting things. Of course, again, I knew that none of that would ever be followed through on. None of those pledges would ever be honoured. But Trump is the establishment on steroids. And yet you see his fans, they get more and more embedded. Stockholm Syndrome, you mentioned. They get more and more embedded. The more he proves that he just is another face of or another version of the system, you know, with his, you know, Zionist cabal, his neocon cabal around him, John Bolton, you know, attacking Syria, handing the country basically over to Israel in terms of US foreign policy. And yet they still swear by him. And you even get stuff like, Jeff, oh, this is all part of some ploy. You know, this QAnon nonsense. Trump is actually in there. What he's really doing is pretending to be going along with all of this, and he's going to blow it up. Jeff, you have to be absolutely whacked out of your mind to believe that Trump is in there, some sort of MacGyver, some sort of Jason Bourne. You know, it's madness, Jeff. You know, what? Have we become so narcissistic that we can't accept when we're wrong? Geez, I'm wrong all the time. I have no problem saying it. I got that wrong. Sorry about that. Oh, listen, do you remember last month I told you something? I was wrong. What is it with people?
It is. That is just a very basic human nature sort of thing that a lot of people will just never admit they're wrong, never admit the truth, and cling to whatever it is that they believe to be true for as long as possible. That's sort of what the Matrix movie was about, is essentially said that the people are so inured to the system that they will kill you if they have to stop you from waking them up to what's going on. And that's essentially what you're seeing with the Trump people. The good news is that there was so many Obama people who thought he was going to change the world and finally black people in the U.S. wouldn't be getting shot by cops anymore. They got shot like three times more. So a lot of the people who moved to the becoming sort of voluntarist anarchists and just saying, I don't want anything to do with this system anymore, came from the Obama movement. The one in particular that I can think of is Carrie Wedler. She was called Obama Girl. After a couple of years of Obama, she said, okay, I'm an anarchist now because this wasn't what I thought it was. And so we're going to see the same with Trump. We're already seeing it. I've seen numerous people who say they believe in freedom who really got behind Trump. They were like, look, he says he's going to stop all the wars. He says he's going to investigate and maybe even shut down the Federal Reserve. He said he was going to put Hillary Clinton in jail, which who cares even if he does that? It's just one person out of, you know, many. And he probably isn't going to, as we've seen. No. Literally within, I think the first night when he got elected, someone asked him what he's going to do with Hillary. And he said, oh, well, the Clintons are good friends of mine. Good they're good people. I wouldn't do anything to hurt them. And that's totally true. The Trump's history, most people don't realize at all because they don't look into anything and they watch the mainstream television programming like it's actual factual information. Trump family has been involved with the Bush family for years. In fact, the Donald Trump's uncle was involved in co-opting and taking over Nikola Tesla's technologies with the senior Bush, who was the head of the CIA at the time, way back in the early 20th century. Then Trump his father was a billionaire. I don't know if he was a billionaire, but he's incredibly rich because, you know, $1 billion was worth a lot back 60 years ago. But he was incredibly rich. And if you look at the numbers, Trump has actually lost money from when he was born. He's lost it numerous times. In fact, he should have been bankrupt over and over and over again, but he was actually protected by the system. They never foreclosed on any of his things because they had him already in place to be the next president. They planned these things out decades, years, if not more, in advance. And you can actually see that. And he was hanging around with the Clintons all the time. But they put on the television programming, and especially on some of these more, you know, alt-media sites that were supporting Trump, that, oh, he's an outsider. He's a billionaire whose whole family has been involved with the same people the Clinton and Bushes have been involved in this entire time. They can't see that. He was actually also trained as a Jesuit in school. Jesuits is one of the top sort of secret societies that are involved in all of these control structures. But your average person will cling to it. Oh, no. Oh, he's an outsider. He's here to save us. No one will save you from politics or government except for yourself. And the only way to do that is if enough of us detach from the system. But it's essentially like George Carlin said, that people over and over again keep electing billionaires who don't give a damn about you, thinking they're there to save you, the little guy who's not getting by very well after all the Federal Reserve inflation and all the government regulations and taxation and all that sort of a thing. And the fact that people still cling that this one guy is going to save us, and that's a little bit what the whole sort of Jesus thing's about too, is getting enough people to believe that we don't have to do anything, but he's going to come back one day and save us. No, we can only save ourselves, and the only way to save ourselves is to wake up and detach from the system entirely.
Great stuff. Loads of tweets on this, unsurprisingly. By the way, Jeff's website, I'm sure you know, but I'll give it to you anyway, dollarvigilante.com. Check it out. Jeff Berwick is live on the line from Acapulco. Look up an Acapulco as well. Interesting. Good to hear that. You've got David there next year as well. I'm sure there'll be a great lineup of speakers, as well as David. Martin Noakes, who's a friend of mine and an old colleague of mine, tweets, David Icke's suggestion is good. When a person is elected by the voters, they should have to sign a contract to enact the things they promised during their campaign. If they don't, they're gone. Paul Jackson tweets, hi Richie, got to say Jeff is spot on with what he is saying here. And Paul Paranoid tweets, I love these Twitter handles. The problem is, Richie, that people are too emphatic when they declare what they think. And then it's all about losing faith. People don't propose ideas, they declare ideology. A couple of years ago, well, more like 3 years ago, I went and spoke very briefly, only for an hour, at a college, a local college in London, Jeff. And I was asking the young men and women there, they were doing a media course, so they were all interested, or at least they claimed they were interested in politics. And I asked them to take a look at party manifestos from successful parties over a period of 15, 20 years. Look at the party manifestos, and they'll be full of things like, when we win, we will build a lot of affordable housing. When we win, we'll make everything great. Everybody will come up with lower taxes. We'll make a lot of new jobs. We'll do all of this. And I said, ultimately, none of that happens. But what does happen is a whole lot of stuff that's not on a manifesto. Stuff like giving billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia, billions of dollars to Israel, bombing the shit out of countries in the Middle East and killing millions and millions of people. It should be obvious to people now. What's really going on. Les Hewitt tweets, Richie, I researched how hypnotism works and came to the conclusion that the majority of people are in a trance. They are hypnotised by the governments and mainstream media. I'm not joking. Hypnotism is a very easy thing to do. Gojira tweets, the United States is lucky they didn't get Don King instead of Trump. Only in America. It's funny when you watch any boxing from the 1980s and early 1990s, you get to see all the criminal cabals that Trump and Don King were a part of. Jeff, do you want to come in on any of those comments, any of those tweets there?
Yeah, on the last one, saying how it's essentially just like the boxing game generally was with people like Don King, it's all just a big show. And the funniest part about Donald Trump is he was actually on the World Wrestling Federation an actor. If you can look him up on imdb.com, he's a reality TV star actor, and that's essentially what they had him in place to do. That's essentially what he is. In fact, most of the top politicians in most countries are essentially actors, the same way that on television, people like, Anderson on CNN, Anderson of all names, the name from The Matrix, he was from the CIA. These are all actors. I actually met the White House press corps at Bilderberg, which is actually going on this weekend, by the way. And I'm not going this year, but many great people are, including Dan Dix and Lee Krodowski and many others. But I went a couple years ago, and we somehow got into the Bilderberg Hotel the night before, and the White House press corps was there. And we were talking to them. And after we told them what we do, they said, oh, you guys are real journalists. And we said, well, what are you? And they were like, we're actors. We just read what we're told off the teleprompter.
Yeah.
And they're not journalists whatsoever. So, you know, but slowly you can see this, Richie, like people are waking up. So just recently, many people started to wake up to how fake the mainstream media is. Even Donald Trump has kind of said that himself about CNN. Of course, he's saying this one's good, that one's not. They're all bad. This is what they do. They always kind of do these things. But we've seen the Sinclair Group in the U.S. put out a thing on NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox. They all read the same script saying, don't pay attention to what you read on the internet. Trust us for your news and that sort of thing. There was literally hundreds of them all saying the same script. So it's all literally just entertainment and script to put out the propaganda message. So people are starting to wake up to that. If you look at the polls in the U.S., the amount of people who actually the question was something like, do you have trust in what mainstream media news? I think it was less than 15%. So people are waking up. And what they do actually, Richie, and you've said, oh, I've seen all these Trump supporters. I've seen the alt-right come out. I've seen the left. There's a lot of people who still believe in this left-right. It actually isn't. If you look at the amount of people who are voting in the U.S., it's less than 50%. I think it's like 30% or something. So you're talking about most of the people just don't even care. And what they do is whenever there is a rally or event, which they try to help out in many ways, whether it be Soros or others, they try to make it seem like, look, there's this huge movement going on. It's usually like even in the U.S., they had the alt-right one in Charlotte, I believe, in North Carolina. And they made it sound like all the Nazis are taking over the U.S. It was like 30 guys. They want us to believe that there's all this chaos and there's all this struggle when there actually really isn't. There's just a few. It's a small percentage who really care and want this left-right thing. The rest of us mostly just want to be left alone and to live a peaceful and happy life. But they will never put that on the nightly news. They'll always try to find one extreme situation to get everyone all in fear and divisive.
Yeah, we're seeing that here. Just on the turnout, not to be contradicting you unnecessarily, but apparently the turnout in the 2016 presidential election was 58%. Now, that's probably, I haven't looked at what it was in 2012, but I'm guessing it probably either slightly fell or only slightly went up, probably because of Trump's participation in it. But I will say this, of those registered to vote, 58% is still quite extraordinary, because you have over 4 in 10 people who've disengaged. You have 4
in 10
people.
Yeah, I guess when I was thinking about less than 50%, I guess I was including like people who aren't 18 and people who can't vote. So yeah, but still, even at the very best, it's about half the people really care.
Amazing, isn't it? I mean, when you think about that, not engaging, just refusing to engage in the system. So on Trump then and trade wars, look, I obviously coming from a trade union background as I do, Jeff, and you know this because we've talked about it before. I know this is absolute bullshit, if I can swear. I know it's bullshit when Trump says, look, I want to protect US industry and all of that. I don't believe it for a minute. But in theory, you know, all things being equal and all things being fair, and if we did live in a free and fair society, we should protect, in our countries, we should protect our steel. Just take that one industry, our steel manufacturers. Why should we see thousands and thousands of our own citizens screwed over by cheap steel being dumped in our country by China or by other European countries, and then to be told that we have to accept it because the European Union says so? So on the face of it, Trump saying, well, look, I want to protect steelworkers, it's a good thing, looking at it in black and white, but it's probably something else going on there, Jeff. What do you think is really going on there?
Whenever you talk about issues of trade and doing things like embargoes and things like that, or tariffs and all those sort of things, it essentially comes down to an actual understanding of economics. If you understand economics properly, and it doesn't take going to 4 years of college, in fact, you'll get through 4 years of college and you won't understand anything about economics, but literally you can read it in a couple hours. There's a book, Economics in One Lesson. Essentially, when you understand economics, you understand that the best thing for humanity is for complete free trade, because I'll give you one example, Richie, and always try to break things down from the big global scale, break it down to like even the city level. So for example, in the US, you have Trump saying things like, let's keep these products out. They're hurting us because they're cheaper and they're better made than we can make them here. Imagine every state in the U.S. said that. So you have Idaho making a lot of potatoes, and people in Texas or New Mexico are like, these potatoes are too cheap and we can't compete. Let's stop those potatoes from coming in. What would happen is everyone would say, that's ridiculous. That's so crazy. But when you have the boundaries at nation level, then all of a sudden it's okay. It actually makes no sense. So what would happen in that particular case is New Mexico isn't great for growing potatoes, as far as I know. know. So all of a sudden, there wouldn't be many potatoes. If there was, they'd be quite expensive and not many people could afford them. So you're actually decreasing the quality of life in a place. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, but we'll have potato jobs. Yeah, but you're destroying the economy in the process bit by bit. So if when you keep out steel that can be made cheaper somewhere else, that's actually a really good thing. Anyone who's a consumer out there knows this. They want something as cheap as possible with the best quality possible. In order to do that, you need to be able to get your resources from wherever they might be that they are best produced in that manner. When you interrupt that process, you essentially make it so you have worse products that are more expensive and generally degrade everyone's life. And you're essentially destroying capital in the process. So over time, everyone becomes poorer and poorer. This is why communism in general turns out to be just everyone starving to death, because you're getting in the way of the market. The market in general works. And so if you say, okay, they're bringing in cheap steel, good. Do you want to build a building and it actually costs 10 times more? Then you can do that by keeping that steel out. But now you've just destroyed a lot of capital and you're actually poorer in the process. But yes, you'll have a steel job, but not for very long, because over time, as everything else happens like this, the economy goes down and down and down. So
let me put the counter argument there. That was a good explanation of where you're coming from. Let me put the counter argument to you. And it's the obvious one that you've heard before. The problem with this cheap steel being dumped on countries like this country here and the United States is it's produced by people who are paid far less than workers are in this country and in the United States, where living standards are entirely different. That's a huge problem, that, and you know that.
How is it a problem? A problem for who?
It's a problem for steel manufacturers in the UK and steel manufacturers in the US, because they can't produce at those rates. They can't. So what are they going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the market telling them that they shouldn't. Right. And they should actually put their capital to something that they can do better or cheaper than somewhere else.
So you have the scenario where you have tens of thousands of people possibly put out of work. We've seen it with Redcar Steel in the northeast of the UK. We've seen it in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania over there, put out of work effectively with nothing else to go to, Jeff. It's not as if there are other jobs just there. You know, we're all right, so we failed. We can't produce the steel as cheap as they can in China. So I'll tell you what, we'll leave and we'll go and work somewhere else. There are no other jobs for them. This is the problem, right?
Well, it is a problem for those particular people, absolutely. But when you allow the market to work, it's for the best for everyone. So yes, if you look at Detroit in the U.S., because of the massive amount of regulations and taxation and the Federal Reserve destroying the dollar in the U.S., it became really difficult for Detroit to compete with people in Japan and places like that. So people there lost their jobs and they had to go and find another way to live. And many of them did. It's a little uncomfortable. That's, you know, the market is not perfect, right? But by trying to keep these things in place, you essentially make everything worse over time to the point where everyone is really poor.
Allow
the market to change.
I agree. Hang on a second. You've said something. You say a lot of things that I agree with, of course, but you've said something there I agree with. You talked about what happened in Detroit, which cost, I would say, you know, not just those working in the plants, but of course, you know, obviously businesses around those plants and communities. You're talking hundreds of thousands of jobs. That wasn't necessarily caused by the fact that people were producing cars cheaper in Europe. You hit the nail on the head. Remind our listeners, why did the city of Detroit go belly up? Why? You mentioned the Federal Reserve and taxation. Go ahead. That's important to make that distinction.
I'm not an expert on the automobile industry, so I probably would get a lot of this wrong. But I know that there was a lot of regulation. That was a big part of what made them not competitive. And, of course, Detroit was sort of a democratically bastion, like Democratic Party, and they had all these very regulations and taxes. It essentially put the business, made it very difficult for them to compete. Now, of course, there is still a few automobile companies in the U.S., but it's quite difficult for them to compete. But in general, it's always better to allow this to happen. If you look at the cars today and where they're made, wherever they make them best and people want, that's where they should be made. And whenever you get in the way of that process, you're just causing damage to to the economy in general, which makes everyone poorer. If we, and you look at governments and they always talk about free trade agreements, and this is what Brexit and all that's all about. And they say, oh, we need a free trade agreement with these countries. That's not a free trade agreement. A free trade agreement would have one sentence. It would say people in the UK can trade with anyone in the world. That's free trade. What is the actual free trade agreements that they come out with? I think the NAFTA one is like 10 phone books of regulations and tariffs and all sorts of corporates, cronies, payoffs and dividends and all kinds of stuff. And this is what they do. They keep people confused. That's why they never teach economics in school, by the way. They never teach anyone what the money system is. If they actually understood the money system, Henry Ford said in the early 20th century, if people understood the monetary system, there'd be a revolution tomorrow. This is impoverishing all of us. So what they do is they make all these problems and then they say they've got the solution. This is the problem, reaction, solution. They do it in every facet of life, including economics. They say, oh, things are bad here. We're going to come in and save you. We're going to put a tariff on steel. Well, that just hurts the other parts of the economy. And now people have to pay more for houses. So the consumers are going to have to pay more now. So what people need to really realize is just getting rid of all of these structures and just allowing completely free trade across the world, which we now have the complete possibility to do, especially with things like cryptocurrencies. You can send money to China in 10 seconds for basically free, like Bitcoin, and no one can even stop it. So we can have complete commerce across the world now without all of these structures, which cause all these problems.
Yeah, and look, I hear that, and we've had this out before. I think you can have protectionism for vital industry like steel. I think you can, without it resulting in the steel becoming, you know, prohibitively expensive for developers. I think you can do that. I think you can subsidize industries as huge as steel, because when you don't, thousands of people are going to be out of work and there isn't anything else for them to do. Not in this
reality.
When you
subsidize, though, essentially what you're saying is extort the people, tax them to give it to the steel companies so that they can stay in business. Well, you just took people's money in order to allow a few of them to have jobs a little longer to create more expensive and worse quality steel products.
Yeah, but I wouldn't tax the people, of course. You know that. I wouldn't tax them. Look, interestingly.
Well, you said subsidize. So how would you subsidize?
Well, I'll explain that. Interestingly enough, I should have told you that Steve Keane was on the program in the first hour, because if I had told you that, you might have had a chance to listen in to what he was saying. But I got Steve to acknowledge that although he disagreed with me about the Central Bank of England, because England, because the UK never joined the single currency, and we still have the pound and we don't have the euro, because it never joined the single currency, Steve said that basically the Central Bank of England is sovereign. And I said, well, I believe to a degree the Central Bank of England is capitalised by the European Central Bank, regardless of the fact that the UK is in the, you know, is not in the euro currency. And he argued with me and said I was wrong. Anyway, fair enough. But ultimately I said, look, you have a scenario where governments still have to borrow, or are borrowing from effectively what is supposed to be their own bank, which is madness. And he put it like this. It's like Richie borrowing from the bank of Richie, or Jeff borrowing from the bank of Jeff, and then having to go and pay it back, and then taxing people into oblivion and austerity in order to pay back a debt even that is absolutely ridiculous. So, you know, if I was given the chance to wave the magic wand tomorrow morning, I wouldn't be subsidising industry like steel by taxing people for it. I wouldn't be doing that at all. I would just be subsidising it, using government money, using government bonds. I know you totally disagree with this, but that's what I would do.
Okay. No, I understand what you're saying. So you're saying you're not going to tax, but you're going to print currency to pay for it. When you do that, you're actually devaluing all the other currency out there, which is actually incredibly detrimental to the economy, because as you print more money, we know this is what happens in every country. As they print more money, the currency becomes less and less of value until the point it becomes worthless, which it has in places like Zimbabwe and Venezuela and things like that. So when you say, well, I'll just
print
up more money,
you're
actually destroying the economy even more by doing that.
No, I'm not talking about printing more money. This is not quantitative easing at all. This is saying that we're going to pay for the vital infrastructure and public services of a country by not borrowing from these banks and then having to pay it back later on at interest, by issuing it where it's needed. I mean, what's better?
But where do you get it?
Well, the same place that the central banks get it. You invent it out of thin air, don't you?
That's what I said. So you'll be increasing the money supply, which actually is one of the worst things you can do for an economy.
It's never been tried,
Jeff. That's another tax.
But it's never been tried, though.
Central banking is actually a scam.
It is a scam. See, you and I agree on 99% of everything. Absolutely right. But what I'm suggesting is never been tried by a democracy in any country, anywhere in the world. Money is taken by governments now from central banks at interest, foisting or imposing a debt on generations of people to come. I'm saying, well, take that same money, but just don't borrow it at debt from a central bank. You know, again, Jeff borrowing from the Bank of Jeff. Use it where it's needed to build social housing, which is affordable housing for people, to build infrastructure, because that, of course, generates jobs and generates money and generates spending in communities and right across cities, and everything comes up. But you're not issuing that money with a debt attached to it. And it's never been tried, right?
The debt part's only one part of it, but the actual increasing the money supply and printing money destroys the currency. So you it might look like, for example, if you had the magic wand, and by the way, no one should have the magic wand, but if you had it tomorrow and you came out and you said, okay, we're going to get rid of the central bank, and I'd cheer, and you'd say, okay, now the government's going to print its own money and there'll be no debt attached to it, I would immediately be selling that currency immediately, because it will start to devalue incredibly fast as you print more and more money. This is what hyperinflation is. Money is no different than any other commodity in the marketplace. When there's more of it, it's worth less. When there's less of it, and that's sort of why Bitcoin's gone up a lot, because it's really restricted in its inflation, it's worth more. So you might create a few jobs for maybe even a year or two. This is what happens. This is how they keep people fooled. They'll create jobs by printing money. That's what the quantitative easing and all that is. The printing of money part of it actually makes people think they're richer and the economy booms, but then they realize that the money's actually become devalued and everything starts to fall apart after that, and then the currency becomes worthless very, very fast. So what you're suggesting is just another way of taxing people. Inflation is just another tax, and essentially what it taxes is anyone who currently holds that currency. So if you came in, you said, we're going to spend 10% more than we currently are to you know, build infrastructure, whatever you said that you want to do, 10% more per year, you'd actually be devaluing the currency by 10%. Within 10 years, the currency would be worth essentially zero, and the entire economy would be obliterated and be worse than places Somalia.
Let me retort. By the way, it's great having Jeff Berwick on. We don't get enough of these discussions on radio these days, sadly. Check out dollarvigilante.com to find out more about Jeff. Very successful entrepreneur. And journalist, and you've got to check out Anarcho Pulco as well, which happens every February, Jeff, isn't it, in Acapulco. There's been some amazing guests there over the years. The point I'm making, and you and I are going to argue this till we're old and grey, we're going to be like the two Muppets in a Muppet Show in the Box, Statler and Waldorf. We're going to be arguing about this for years. It's never been tried my way. The way that it happens at the moment results in what? It results in what David Icke has coined as the term, and you'll be hearing from David next year, the Hunger Games society. It results in this inequality that you reckon would ultimately disappear with a free market and no government involvement. What we have at the moment is we have everything paid for through government-issued bonds, through central banks, which results in a unsustainable debt being put on people generation after generation, where the government comes back and says, oh, we can't, all this stuff that we paid for, the National Health Service and everything else, we can't afford it. So we've got to tax you more, and we've got to bring in these austerity measures. We've got to cut funding to programs, various programs right across the spectrum. What I'm saying is, I'm not talking about just printing money recklessly and just throwing money into the economy. No, I'm not. I'm saying controlled and sensible money creation with no debt attached to it, where you say, right, we do need a million houses, Jeff. This country here, where I'm speaking to you from, we need at least 2 million to 3 million houses for people to be able to afford to buy them, because there are no houses. So, right, I'm going to effectively give the money to the construction industry to do that. That is going to generate hundreds of thousands of jobs. I mean, it literally is. And I'm not going to go back as the government in 2 years' time to the taxpaying public to say, oh, by the way, do you remember all that money that I loaned into existence to give the construction industry? Oh, now you've got to pay it back. It doesn't get paid back. And that's never been tried before. is all I'm saying.
Well, actually, I disagree. It's actually been tried everywhere since 2008 when interest rates essentially went to 0%. So you've had a case of massive money printing over the last 10 years, and interest rates have been near 0%, close enough to zero to just call them zero. In fact, negative interest rates in parts of Europe. And that's on purpose because they can't allow the interest rate to rise because there's so much debt. So you're essentially – what you've seen in the U.S. and Europe for the last 10 years is your plan. And you can see it just doesn't work. Now, what you're saying is they shouldn't spend it on wars. They shouldn't spend it on building houses. Well, that's essentially sort of communism's top-down central planning. And you would actually destroy the real estate industry. You would destroy so many things by doing that. Whereas if you just left it all alone, everything would be fine. Just get rid of the governments and central banks. Everything would be completely fine. If there's not enough places for people to live in England, well, then maybe people should stop living there or having babies.
Do you know why
it's not up to us to.
Do you know where we fundamentally
create money to,
this is
to
where,
build houses for people?
This is good stuff. This is where you and I fundamentally disagree. I believe that the workers, the people, should control the means of production. You know that this is what I believe.
Oh, you're a communist then?
Yeah, well no, I'm not going to be labeled communist or socialist or anything.
That's essentially the entire thing about communism. Well, the workers control the means of production.
But I might say something else in 10 minutes that you might say, well, that's very conservative or that's very right wing. Yes, Jeff, I do. I've always believed that the natural resources of this planet shouldn't be co-opted or taken by any man or any corporation for himself or for the benefit of that corporation. I just don't believe that. I'll never believe it. It doesn't make me a communist. It makes me a realist, as far as I'm concerned. It makes me a humanist more than anything. The workers should control the means of production, I believe. What's wrong with that? That's never been tried anywhere either. Don't say it's been...
That's communism.
Don't say it's been tried... It hasn't been tried in Russia. Never.
It ends in mass murder and death.
Never.
And poverty.
You know it's never been tried anywhere, Jeff.
Sure it has.
Because
it's been tried in various forms.
Because corruption, selfishness... Don't have me to talk about Lenin, Stalin. Don't have me to get into all that. It's never been...
No, I know what you're saying, Lenin.
It's never been tried, right?
Done it because whenever you have a power structure, whether it be more communist or more capitalist, so more like the Soviet Union or more like the U.S., whenever there's that central planning, it always will become corrupted. It's almost a given. This is what we've talked about. That's what the whole movie The Lord of the Rings was about. That ring of power is no one can handle it. And whenever you have... So if you create your perfect sort of semi-communist system where the workers own the means of production and you're in charge with the magic wand, within a couple of years, you'll be giving out all the deals to all your buddies. This just happens naturally.
Not me, Jeff. I'm a saint, not me. But look, I don't entirely disagree with you. It's look, it's grown up stuff. This, you know, there are a lot of our listeners tweeting. A lot of them agree with Jeff. You know, quite a few see where I'm coming from. I'm going to give you the final word. We're nearly out of time. It's great to have these discussions, Jeff. You know, we just don't have them. Check out, and that's not to patronise Jeff, very, very smart, very successful man, Anarcho-Pulco, hugely exciting conference every year in February, coming up for the fifth one. David Icke is going to be there, Jeff says. Dollarvigilante.com. Final word to you, my friend. Remind me why I'm wrong. And if we leave it open, if we leave it up to them, I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to interrupt you. If we leave it up to the markets, why will that work? Final word, 2 minutes. Go ahead.
The only thing I would say is that you can believe whatever you want and do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anyone else. So if you put in place a structure where you're in charge of certain things and you're actually extorting people, you say you're going to print the money, but that's a little bit of a different topic. But you can go ahead and do whatever you want as long as I can go ahead and do whatever I want as well. And that's really the key to everything is no person should be, and you agree with this, no people should be owned by other people without their consent. And that's essentially what government is. So, if we had a true free market, I'm sure there'd be pockets of places that do what you do. And we would see if they do well or not. I don't think they do very well because the incentives aren't correct. However, they might do well. Great. Awesome. As long as you're not hurting anybody, I don't care. Have your sort of semi-communist sort of area. And I'd rather live in a place where people really respected private property and that sort of thing. We'll see how we do. But that would all be so much better than what we have today. So for anyone out there listening that's interested in these sort of topics. We talk about this a lot at our conference in Acapulco, anarcapulco.com, coming up February 14th to 17th in Acapulco, Mexico. And David Icke, Ron Paul, Jeje Napolitano, Cynthia McKinney, Doug Casey, so many other people will be there.
Great lineup, Jeff. Terrific lineup. Dollarvigilante.com, anarcapulco.com, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Love these chats, Jeff. I really do. That's, again, not to butter you up. I look forward to these chats and I look forward to the next one. Thanks for coming back.
My pleasure, Richie.
Great work. Terrific guy, Jeff Berwick. And Jeff is on Twitter as well. I'll tweet out a link to his Twitter handle. But if you look for Dollar Vigilante, you'll find him on Twitter as well. Top man. Right, that's it for the programme. Change to the schedule this week. I'm away tomorrow evening. But there will be a 2-hour live programme on Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock UK time to make up for my absence tomorrow. That's Friday at 4 o'clock, 2-hour live show. Kind of drive time show I'll be doing with guests on Friday. So I'm away tomorrow, but back Wednesday at 7 as usual, Thursday at 7 as usual, and then Friday at 4 for 2 hours as usual. I'm going to the Rolling Stones. They're in Manchester tomorrow evening, and I was given a present of a pair of tickets to the Stones by a friend of mine months ago. So I'm going to the Stones tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday at 7, Friday at 4 for 2 hours. That's the schedule this week. Thanks to Jeff Berwick, thanks to Professor Steve King. Going to leave you with this from Genesis, and thanks to Simon for looking after YouTube, Simon Stewart as well. That's it for Monday's programme. Thanks for listening to it. Speak to you Wednesday at 7. Bye for now.